Richard Dolan holds an M.A. in history from the University of Rochester, a B.A. in history from Alfred University. He earned a certificate in political theory from Oxford University. He was a Rhodes Scholar finalist in 2000. He published a 500-page study, UFOs in the National Security State. That was the first volume of a two-part historical narrative of the national security dimensions of the UFO phenomenon from 41 to the present. In 2003, he helped found a magazine called Phenomena, dedicated to leading-edge issues pertaining to science and society. But a little bit later on in the program, we'll tell you about some of Richard's new endeavors to bring you more information about the field of UFOs. Our special guest, always welcome. Richard, how are you?
Hi, George. Hey, thanks for having me on. Quick correction. I was a Rhodes finalist, but that was a million years ago in the late Jurassic period.
I'm not going to age you.
Back in 1984. Not 2000.
I'm not going to age you, but all right.
2000, man. Wow, that would be cool.
You know, you could do it. You know,
it's great to be on.
The last time I met you, we were at a conference.
Yeah.
We shook hands for just a bit, and you came on and joined me, I think, in 2005, November-ish.
Yeah.
And we talked about this, you know, the national security state of UFOs. Is that continuing? Are we getting any closer to some kind of disclosure, Richard?
Well, I will tell you, I have been working like the Dickens, as they say, to finish the next volume of my study. I wrote volume one, which came out like 5 years ago, which covers basically the 1940s up to the early 70s. And it was really all that I could do to get up to that point. I've been researching ever since from the early 70s to the present day, and I'm in the home stretch of getting this next study done. It'll be about 600 pages or so. And so, yeah, I mean, the story, there's a major story that has continued, obviously, for the last 35 years regarding UFOs and government secrecy, and it is absolutely current. This has not gone away. Clearly, there's still a major phenomenon worldwide. You have government authorities, plural. You got them, not just the United States, but other nations as well that are interested in this. There's secrecy about this. So yeah, it's an important thing. And whether or not secrecy is going to end, well, this is, of course, the question. And I ask myself that question usually several times a day, George. So,
well, why can't we get this home run witness, Richard, to come forward? You know, Stephen Greer years ago with his Disclosure Project had his press conference at the National Press Club, and
right.
You know, some pretty good witnesses came forward. I thought, but it just doesn't seem that the data, the evidence, what we need to really get the world to wake up and say this really is going on. Is coming out.
Right. Well, I would say it's two things. I remember when that press conference was being held, when Stephen Greer organized that in 2001. And I was brand new in the UFO field, in fact, and a lot of people asked me, hey, this is going to do it, don't you think? And actually, I kept saying, no, I don't think so. It would be nice if it does. But it didn't. And I think there's two reasons. One, it's not that there aren't any leaks and there aren't good people coming out giving information. In fact, there are. And it's not that there aren't good, very good, government documents that have discussed this matter in sufficient detail, because there are a lot of those as well. But what we don't have is there's not like this official government acknowledgement. I mean, think of something like the Kennedy assassination. It's a good example. 80%, I think, something like 80% of Americans believe that there was a conspiracy to kill JFK. All right, that's a lot of people.
Yes.
And yet there's no official government acknowledgement. So you go on to official news media, MSNBC or any of the major networks, whatever, and they still go by the official story that it was Lee Harvey Oswald, and that's it. So that you've got this widespread understanding of a truth within a society, but that doesn't mean that official acknowledgement is going to follow. And the other thing about UFO secrecy that I'm really coming to understand is that it's very possible that we need to start looking at UFO secrecy as something that is really almost beyond even formal government control. And so that it may be something more proprietary than actually classified. So that one has to really ask, are these secrets being kept within formal government bodies? And the answer possibly is, well, no, not really. Does the president know everything that there is to know about UFOs? I think most of us would probably agree, probably not. And so if not the president, then whom? And is it in a government agency? Or is the answer possibly in private contractors who many now suspect have an inordinate amount of leverage on this issue? So where the secrets are kept is a really good question. And one of the things I've been trying to figure out for myself is to understand what you might call the architecture of secrecy. It's not all that easy to do all the time. But from what I'm seeing, I'm seeing more and more that there are serious private elements to this, not simply public elements.
I had a couple sources, Richard, about a year ago who came forward. They have met with me, and they are working on getting a couple major government employees to come forward to them publicly with what they need. And if that happens, they're going to share that with us. Obviously, I want to pull you in on that if that occurs. Yeah. Been going on. It's been going on for a year. And you see how you get impatient with something like this.
Oh, absolutely, George. And like you, I mean, I'm in a position where from time to time people will come to me. I'm sure in your case you get an enormous traffic of very, very interesting people who have things to say to you privately. I get that as well to a lesser extent, but I still get it. Some of the people that I talk to are fairly prominent individuals, I have to say. From a variety of directions, the story that I'm getting is that the problem has gone really beyond government in a lot of ways and is burrowed away within the bowels of the Department of Defense, but within programs that are known as special access.
Sure. Or what about the shadow government? Maybe they've taken control of all of this.
That's right. And they do it through these special access programs, which have absolutely zero public oversight. I mean, Congress doesn't even have – no one in Congress has clearance to review these. So, in fact, literally – These special access programs have carte blanche, really, to do whatever they want. They have almost an infinite amount of money to do what they want. Black budget. One of the issues of my next book is black budget issues. It's become one of my mini obsessions, is trying to figure out what is this thing? Where's all this secret money going? But the thing is, there are the information that I've been getting is that there are at least one of these special access programs, probably more, but one specifically deals with the study of acquired alien technology and the study of the associated bodies that came with that. And that our top generals are unable to get access to this program. And in fact, I know one story in which a senior general learned about such a program, banged on a bunch of doors, tried to get access, and was sat down with essentially a bunch of corporate types, you know, lawyers and accountants.
Right.
And basically they said, look, General, sorry, you don't have a need to know. The only reason he got an audience was because they wanted to find out how the leak occurred.
You don't have a need to know. They say that to a general.
Yeah, like a big general with a bunch of stars on his lapel. So, so that's the story. I mean, if you're a public servant, there are a lot of public servants within the military. These are people who believe in what they do. They're not all part of the evil national security state, as I have in the title of my book. There's many, many good people out there, and they believe in serving their country, and yet they're blocked from doing so by what has become a private money-making machine. I mean, think about it. If you and I were in with the in crowd and we had access to some of this exotic technology, I mean, my God, we'd have the future right there in the palm of our hands. So that you could send a piece of material out to some scientist over here and then to another scientist there, and you'd say, study this electromagnetic property and study this and study that. And then a couple of years later, they'd come back to you and they'd say, wow, I don't know where you got this, but this stuff is amazing, and I can't duplicate its properties, but I can do this thing. I can improve our integrated circuits, or I can make high tensile fibers, or I can make whatever. And so there's an amazingly profitable ground floor investment opportunity and no incentive for sharing the secret with anybody. I mean, why would you ever want to share that? And what has happened is, it's not simply with UFOs, of course, but with the military in general, we've given out so much to contractors. Contractors do the work that that soldiers often used to do, and also contractors have access to the technology that are beyond standard DoD. So, for example, if you have a scientist that you need to study a piece of material, he's not going to be a military scientist. He's going to be with some university or some corporation. And so the secrets seem to have been going private for many, many years. And trying to track, like, is it military, is it private? Well, once it goes private, I mean, if it's in the possession of Lockheed or Boeing or Raytheon or some corporation like that, how do you get access to it?
Well, you can't. I mean, international espionage is even tougher to crack than military.
Exactly. So this is where it's looking like the situation's going. And you know, one thing that I'm learning is, as I get older, I include myself here. We get stuck in old ways of looking at the world. I remember when I was 10 years old and I took a civics class, and you know, how is it in fifth grade? Well, you vote for your representative, and they vote on laws, and you've got your Congress and your Senate, and they got checks and balances. And I mean, hey, listen, man, the world doesn't work like that. That's not what it is. You've got a completely new world, a different world, and yet I think all of us, to some extent, lack what I would call the conceptual tools to really understand how this world is configured and how it's structured, so that we can kind of have a roadmap to figure out who's got what, who owns what, who's got the power. The old, you know, method, the old ideas of political science that I think we all kind of live with in our mind, I don't think these are relevant. I think most of them are obsolete.
Richard, you've been looking at this for well over 35 years of UFO history,
yeah.
And you know, this is a very savvy audience. They've heard a lot. They've heard,
yes,
many cases. Is there anything out there that might be new or older cases that just haven't been revealed yet that you can share with us?
Yeah. There's a lot that I've been stumbling across. I mean, it's almost hard for me to single out one or two, but there's a couple from the 70s and 80s, and there's a couple just from very recent that I'm thinking of. There's one case from 1988. Yeah, here it is. March of 88, which before I really did this research, I'd never heard of it. But it's a great case because it's one of the few cases from the 1980s where we've got some government documents that really nail it down and prove that it actually happened exactly as claimed. On Lake Erie, in which an object, it was during when the lake was frozen, and a family, a husband and wife, are driving with their small child, and they see this object hovering over the lake. It's like rocking end to end, like they said it was like a teeter-totter. They had a bright light on it and a strobing light. So they're watching this for a while, and it was like a gunmetal gray, and it's revolving slowly, like rotating. They call the Coast Guard. So the Coast Guard comes to check this out. Out of this object, everyone's watching it. They've got these smaller objects are coming out of the large object, and they're zigzagging, and they're like these little triangular objects, and they're zigzagging at incredibly high speeds across the lake. One person said they crossed like a 50-mile stretch over low over the ice in the snap of a finger, all really fast. The Coast Guard patrol vehicle had arrived, and they're looking at this just like when their mouths agape. They're calling it in, and I mean, the thing is, like, I got the report here. I've got the whole report describing this. So you've got a family, you've got Coast Guard, you've got a report, and this object stayed there for like several hours. It was this bright, like when they got a close look at it, it was this triangular object as it traveled across the sky and just went pew, gone, just zip, gone.
And you know, it could be military, but what are the odds?
If it, right, exactly. And if it is military, this is the thing. a lot of people say, oh, yeah, that's probably military. And I'm like, okay, fine. Aren't you curious, like, what makes this thing go? I mean, look, we got $3 a gallon gas these days. Whatever that thing's using, I assume it isn't high-octane gasoline.
No, far from that, Richard.
Something a little more exotic. And here we are sitting on our duffs thinking, well, Big Brother will let us have access to this technology when he's good and ready. And you know what? I'd like to know what makes that go, if it's military. But is it? And as you say, what are the odds? I think very low. Now it is true that, I think that we've got some very exotic technologies secretly held. And the real question is, how exotic is our stuff?
And do other countries possess the same thing?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I don't know the answer to some of these questions.
They say the Germans did during World War II. That's why they had an advance. That's why they had a jump on so many people technologically.
They did. And in fact, I will tell you that I myself saw with my own eyes a German flying saucer. Couldn't get into it. It's kind of little. It's maybe, 3 feet in diameter.
Did it look man-made?
Yeah, it was man-made. It was
reversed engineered type.
Well, I wasn't told that was the case. My understanding was that this was developed by one particular German scientist, actually a well-known one, but
who probably joined us after the war, maybe.
Yes, actually, who did? I'm being cagey here.
I'm
trying to think, like, what am I supposed to say?
I can tell. I'm trying to pull it out of you. You know who it is.
I know who the scientist is. Yes, he's.
He's not alive anymore, is he?
No, he's long dead. But the thing is, it was a prototype.
Would Werner have given you the approval to use his name?
No, it wasn't Werner von Braun. Okay. No. He was a missile guy anyway. He wasn't doing saucers. This was like a prototype, and it was one of only a very few, I was told, that this particular scientist made during the war, and it wasn't flown. The scientist didn't believe that it had the material properties to withstand the RPM and so forth. But the point is that the Germans were, at the very least, making disc-shaped aircraft, or disc-shaped, let's say, craft of some sort. The question is, how far do they get with it? And this, I'm not 100% convinced that they had operational craft. I do believe, I'm very satisfied that they were working on all kinds of very exotic prototypes, and also that we got access to that after the war ended.
Richard, when we come back, let's talk about some of these occupants, some of these creatures, if they have come across your desk, some of this information over the last 35 years. Richard Dolan, our guest, his website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll come back in just a moment. We'll talk about the national security state and the UFOs, the cover-up, he believes, since 1941. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast. Richard Dolan, our guest. We're going to talk with Richard a little bit later on about some of his new endeavors, things that will educate you even more. Richard, creatures, occupants.
Yeah.
Those fascinate me. What do we have in your old portfolio?
Well, there. This is probably information that a lot of listeners, some of this may be old hat to them. I will just say that my little journey for the last decade in UFO studies has been a real education, George.
Well, yeah,
I started
true.
Out so conservatively. Back in the mid-90s, I thought, gee, I don't want to know about aliens. I don't really want to know about abductions or any weird stuff. I just want to know, is the military interested, yada, yada, yada. But I couldn't just dip my little toe into the water.
Right.
I realized I got to go in. When you go in, now you start getting into all the truly bizarre stuff, and that includes beings. What's the story? What are these beings? Are there more than one type and so forth? And what I would say is, this is what I think. I always have to distinguish from what I think with what I know. And I don't know that there are multiple numbers of alien beings here, but I think that there are. I don't know that they're interested in us the way that farmers are interested in livestock, but I think that they are. For example, I think, you know, what I see, judging on the basis of an analysis of abduction testimony, people who claim that they've been abducted by aliens. One thing that we can ask ourselves is, do these people have a consistent story to tell? The answer is, by and large, that they do. Now critics can shoot back and say, hey, well, you're just extracting out of them what you want to extract. I do not believe that personally. I've been privileged to sit in on a number of, not many, but enough abduction regression sessions. And I got to tell you, I'm just not seeing this happening at all. I'm not seeing people who do regression extracting certain kinds of desired information out of alleged abductees. What I'm seeing is that a good therapist will almost try to steer them in a different way, and that the people who are undergoing regression will often say, no, it wasn't like that at all. This is how it was. And they'll give these very detailed descriptions of certain things. So I think that the regression technique is by and large valid. That doesn't mean that it doesn't have mistakes in there. I mean, it's not infallible.
You know, I had a great opportunity to talk with Whitley Strieber not too long ago, and, you know, his new work called The Grays.
Yeah, I'm reading it.
Great job he did.
I'm in the middle of it.
Great jobs. But what it tells you is there's something out there very strange, very unusual. You of course, would agree with that because you do work in this field.
Yeah.
He doesn't even know what they are. I mean, he just doesn't know.
It's hard. You know, we're only so smart, okay? We're not at their level. It's like, I remember years ago I was studying my dog. I was feeding him. And I thought, well, he's a really smart guy. He knows where his food is, and he knows me, and he knows a lot of things that I don't even know, sounds and smells and so forth. But he didn't know how the food got into the can of dog food, right, into the can. And he didn't know how human factories exist to create dog food, and he didn't know how he's been taken out of his natural environment to be a domesticated dog. It's not that he didn't know. It's that he couldn't know. And I thought, well, gee, Rich, you're such a smart guy. Your dog's at this level. You're a little higher. What's higher than that? All right, we do probably have limits as to what we're able to understand. And I don't know that we're bumping into those limits here with the UFO phenomenon, but sometimes I wonder that we are. But regarding what these other creatures are, I mean, look, there's a consistency with what a lot of abductees are saying. There's little question in my mind that they are here to some extent to test us and also to breed us. To some extent.
And they might have also genetically altered us.
They must have. I mean, think of it this way, just even logically. Let's say that you're a visitor and you're here. But well, you're not really a visitor, though, are you? You're basically living here. So where would you live? Well, you might not live on the surface of the planet. It might not be good for you. I mean, you got solar radiation that you're not designed for, and you got microbes and all of those nasty little things. So what I think you would do is you'd create a nice sanitary environment for yourself, probably under the ground. But you may need to go topside every so often. You may want to interact with the human population and other population. So would you perhaps create your own little captive human population and breed them in a secure area? Yeah, I bet you would.
Sure would.
And would you modify them genetically? Why not? Would you put little implants in them and make them even better than before? I believe this. My suspicion is that when people talk about sightings of the bizarre men in black or the humans who don't seem quite human and what have you, my strong suspicion, I haven't really talked about this with any other researchers, but I think that it's the case that these very well could be humans, but they're not of our civilization. They're really of the other civilization.
Well, there's only, you know, if you believe in the theory that everything in the universe is the same, okay, the elements,
and
I believe that. You have to assume that if there is life out there, it could be very similar to us.
Yes, exactly. You know, exactly.
You know, if the evolution of, you know, your brain means that you end up looking somewhat human, that's probably where we are. I mean, you just look at the abundance of life on this planet, you know, you look at a dog, you look at a cat, you look at the snake, a frog. Everything's got eyes, nose, ears. I mean,
we're all what they call tetrapods.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is the same throughout the entire universe.
You could very well be right on that. The other thing that I wonder is, like, let's say a hyper-advanced, super-smart species comes here, but that they can't just interact on a normal biological basis. Would they create their own species based on native genetic DNA of that planet? I think, well, maybe they could. I mean, maybe that's what we're seeing as well. There's all kinds of possibilities, and when you deal with very, very closed-minded skeptic people, not an open-minded skeptic, but a closed-minded skeptic who says, well, space travel is impossible, they can't get here, all of this stuff that we've heard, and it's just old news, it's old science. They're not thinking of the real kinds of possibilities that are out there. I'm not saying have such an open mind as they say that your brain falls out, but I'm saying have an open mind. And that there are, we're not done with our technological development. We're one generation away from having computers and machines that are as smart as we are in the minds of some AI experts. I mean, we're 20 years away from you waking up saying, hello, computer. And your computer says, hey, George, how are you? And you have an entire conversation with your computer. And you might wake up and say, hey, I'd like 20 minutes of stand-up, if you don't mind.
Well, I just saw some video of a Chinese robot today.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a woman robot. She costs $36,000.
Yeah.
And she talks to you. It's voice recognition. She moves around. I mean, it's bizarre.
Yeah, there are some really good ones out there. You know, you obviously know where they're going to go with this. This is all going to be for sex, right?
Oh,
guaranteed.
Richard.
Come on, listen, this is where everyone, look at the internet, look at all these developments. One of my favorite books.
You're serious.
Oh, totally, man. Not for me, of course. I'm happily married. Seriously, read, there's one of my favorite books on the future of AI is by a guy named Ray Kurzweil called The Age of Spiritual Machines. It's just a brilliant book. And Kurzweil, I think he's nailed it. And he says, look, this is all driven by sex. And, you know, computers, I mean, not all.
Let's not even go there. It's too sickening to even think about.
Well, it's how the human mind is, though. And one thing that Kurzweil says is he's like, look, I really foresee a period like when we're going to have an easy time reproducing because people are going to be spending all their time with artificial relationships because that'll be easier and less hassle than real relationships. That's what he thinks.
Well, maybe, I tell you what, if humankind thinks that way, maybe that's why they're trying to genetically alter us.
Well, we're in some trouble. Well, you got a lot of people just living in front of their computer screen already. I mean, and it's just probably going to get worse, not better. What I was going to say, though, with AI is simply that we're about a generation away, because I really did get sidetracked, sorry.
You did get sidetracked.
From computers that sound and talk like us, but can also do a quadrillion number of calculations per second and can also pull any bit of information off the internet. So they'll be like us, but really much smarter.
And just add 50 years to this technology, add 100
Absolutely.
Years to this technology. You know, I've always said that, you know, we could be dealing with civilizations that are thousands, if not millions of years older than ours.
Exactly. No,
we're only 4.5 billion years old in a universe that now could be 15 billion years old.
Yeah, science has just extended the age of the universe a bit. And, we really wouldn't be able to compete, except my suspicion, though, is that because of forthcoming developments in artificial intelligence, at least if some of these AI theorists are correct, what they're seeing is a kind of spike in the development of machine intelligence on this planet, in our civilization, almost like an exponential spike, like a quantum jump, like when we went from Neanderthal to modern human species. So we're going to be looking at a massive leap, not a quantitative, but a qualitative leap. And so if that's so, we might be positioned to deal with an advanced intelligence in a much better way than we can currently deal with it within, say, 50 years. We might have, in other words, significantly advanced capabilities that we don't currently have or that we don't yet have, as far as we can tell.
You're putting together information for another book, right? Is it going to be part two of UFOs in the national security state? Are you extending? Because this the first one went from 41 to 73. Are you going out now?
Yeah, the next book is going from 73 to 2006.
Okay.
And when that book ends, it will end whatever that day is in 2006 that I finished writing it. That's when it ends.
Have you found that things have changed drastically since the 41 to 73 period as compared to the 73 to 2006 period?
Yes. I mean, a lot of things have changed drastically. Our society has changed radically. When you go back to 1973, for those of us old enough to remember, I'm old enough to remember.
Well, I am too. I was 23 then.
Yeah. You had about 10 years on me there. I was...
You had to say that.
Anyway.
You're old for two. You're old for two today.
I'm feeling older, okay? I'm feeling creaky. It's happening to me, too.
Say one more, and I pull the plug like I did. Did you
yes,
see
sir.
That?
Sorry.
I can do that. I've got the plug.
I'll be good.
I can snip your phone at any time.
1973. There was a new show on BBC I've just been checking out called Life on Mars. It's not about Mars. It's about this cop from 2006 who gets hit by a car, and when he wakes up, the year is 1973. It's an awesome show, and he's trying to get back into his own time. And they call it Life on Mars because the year 1973, he said it's like living on Mars. So, and it's great because there's no computers, right? There's stacks and stacks of paper. We lived in a different society in many ways. And in UFO research and in the UFO situation, things were very different. Like one thing that I've noticed, how the Internet has just utterly transformed research on the UFO topic, as it has transformed everything, of course. But in like the mid-1970s, if we can go back 30 years and remember, the Freedom of Information Act in the mid-70s was a brand new thing.
Yes. Everything was suppressed then.
It was. And in 74 and then several times during the Carter years, the Freedom of Information Act was strengthened considerably. And what that meant was researchers felt like for the first time, here we go. Now we've got a chance to take a sledgehammer and crack this wall of secrecy open. And it was a really great time to try to do it. I mean, it was after Watergate. It was after Vietnam. The mood of the United States was probably more liberal than it has ever been before or since, I think, in a lot of ways. And so there was a very strong momentum to try to end government secrecy when people were looking at the abuses of the Nixon administration, for example. And so researchers in the late 70s sent out FOIA requests, one after the next after the next, and to the amazement of a lot of people, they got back thousands of pages of government documents pertaining to UFOs. After years and years and years of these agencies saying, nah, we don't do nothing with UFOs, FBI, CIA, all the military agencies, were collecting these. And now of those documents, it's true that there wasn't a single smoking gun, like there wasn't the penultimate memo from the president.
Was that disappointing to you?
Well, I think it was disappointing to everyone involved, but there was a lot of excitement, too.
Why?
Because the documents that did come out were one cut below, and they described utterly awesome military encounters with objects that there's no way that you could say that these make any sense. And there's a lot of them. In 1976, we got, through the Freedom of Information Act, almost immediately the report of a famous encounter that took place over Tehran by the Iranian Air Force. And you could say, well, that's Iranian, but they were allies of the United States. They were flying American munitions, and we had flying American aircraft, and we had massive documentation going to the White House on this encounter. And we were able to get access to it almost immediately. And in fact, this encounter, which some people know about, but as one of the quotes from the document is, as the F-4 approached a range of 25 nautical miles, he lost all instrumentation and communications. When the F-4 turned away from the object and apparently was no longer a threat to it, the aircraft regained all instrumentation. And then another brightly lighted object came out of the original object. The second object headed straight toward the F-4. I mean, just amazing. You had two F-4s in a row trying to intercept this bright, bright object over Tehran, which would emit these little objects that would intercept the F-4s instead. Anyway, we got this document describing it in four detailed pages. So, and this is all Freedom of Information Act stuff. There's no way to get stuff like that today. Freedom of Information Act has been so amazingly gutted that you can't, that most UFO researchers today, they don't even look at FOIA as a useful tool. They're moving further and further away from it. I've talked to so many people who've spent a lot of time in the archives. I was in the National Archives myself earlier this year. And I'll tell you, man, if you want to research World War II or Korea, you're in luck. You can get all you want. It's all 50 years old. If you want recent material, you're not going to find it. And there was a story that came out.
The Kenny stuff is still suppressed for 50 years, isn't it?
Yeah, it's horrible. It's horrible. That's right. It is still suppressed. There was it just came out earlier in 2006 that the head of the National Archives stated, he said, there's an agency that's been classifying documents, and I don't know who they are or why they've been doing it. Documents that had been declassified under Clinton in 95. Someone ordered the reclassification of thousands of documents. So, like, if you had gotten a document declassified in 1998, that document now could be classified, and you would not be allowed to show it to anyone. And we don't know who's been doing this. There's no authority that has been given for this reclassification. What kind of world are we living in here? So the Freedom of Information Act, as far as UFO, current UFO cases goes, is a very limited utility, unfortunately. But it wasn't seen that way in the 70s. And so in the late 70s, it was really possible for researchers to think. The other thing about researchers in the 70s was that in the 80s, there was a much greater trust in their government. Even those researchers who believed that there was a government conspiracy, their attitude was, well, the government's doing this. I don't agree with their secrecy, mm-hmm. but they're doing it because they feel it's in our best interest. Okay, there was this level of trust that existed.
Well, that's gone.
In the 70s, and it's totally gone. There's no trust. No one has trust in government.
At least 63%, though.
Right, that's a political party thing, and that's significant. But I think on a larger level, that trust has been eroding from by the people over many years. And I think, yes, what's happened in the last 5-6 years has been very, very, very extreme.
You remember the movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that in a moment, because I want to see how realistic that could be and what you think would happen. Our guest tonight, Richard Dolan. Richard's been working on a television project, and we're going to talk about his latest book again when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Richard, The Day the Earth Stood Still, Klaatu comes down. He comes out of his spaceship only to get shot by an overzealous soldier.
Yeah, what a great movie.
Yeah, wonderful. But could it happen? Could it happen nowadays?
Well, one thing that is definitely true is that there are no shortage of accounts of military, what certainly seem like military attempted encounters, hostile encounters with UFOs. There's dozens of these. And so, this is the one thing that makes me think, well, they're just not all secret black projects, because we seem to be fighting these things. And not just our military. There are cases of Russian military as well encountering them. So, yeah, they're here, and we don't seem to be entirely pleased about it, at least at the covert, at the military level, secretly. There seems to be some hostility there. Now, whether it's open warfare, I don't know, but there doesn't seem to be entirely friendly relations, because, look, just even a couple of years ago, there's one of the few stories that actually got out in 2002 of two F-16s chasing an object right outside Washington, D.C., seen by many people. I've spoken to one of the witnesses in detail and read accounts of others. This bluish object just zipping across the sky just outside D.C. This is a year after 9/11. Two F-16s going across the sky after it. I can't think that that's one of ours. I mean, could it be?
Why would we chase it?
No, it's 1:30 in the morning. I don't understand it. So I think that we are in a confrontational posture toward a lot of these others, let's call them. That movie, though, The Day There Still, is just, I saw it years ago and then recently saw it again, and I just thought, wow, this movie It's a great film, and it's a really it's a smart movie. It's one of the only films of like the early 50s that just lays into American kind of aggressive military culture, and you don't get that too many times in the early 50s from pop culture,
You know, why would we be so dumb to militarily try to get involved with them? I mean, if they got here, they had incredible technology in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, we would be facing suicide.
One would think. And yet, I don't know what to make of these many reports that, I mean, why, for example, I mentioned before the last break, the 1976 encounter over Tehran. It's a fact that we are constantly going after these guys, and when we get too close, they disable our instrumentation frequently, or some other bad things happen. On the other hand, you know, there are cases where these objects have been seen violating sensitive military airspace, and we've not done a thing about it. In fact, during 1975, I mean, I'm sorry I got to go back 30 years, but again, that's where we have got some documentation. In 75, across the entire northern U.S. border, there were a series of utterly awesome violations of sensitive airspace by objects unknown that were hanging out over missile silos and weapons depots, totally unopposed. And this happened many, many times from Maine out to Montana, all across the northern U.S. border and into Canada as well, Canadian bases there. And in certain cases, these objects were hovering 300 feet over weapons storage depots, and the base commanders typically were terrified to try to do anything about it. They didn't want to provoke whatever these things were, and we've got documents on it. So we're not always trying to knock them out of the skies. It's true, but there are lots of cases in which we apparently are chasing. And then you've got many. Let's say alleged eyewitness accounts. I mean, these are not confirmed by documentation, but there are so many, George, I have to think that some of these are true, in which people say, yeah, I saw this object and I saw these jets chase after it. I've spoken to a couple of witnesses directly who described in detail how that kind of thing happened. So why are we chasing them when we have no chance of taking them out?
If anything, we have a better chance of getting captured. Taken away. Who knows what could happen? And I believe that has happened.
Yeah, right. I do too. It could be a case where, let's say you're making policy on this, and you know that they're here, and you're thinking, well, how do I deal with this? I can't go after them every time because that's not going to work.
Richard, hold for 1 second because I've got Richard C. Hoagland on with an update on the space shuttle Atlantis. Richard, what's the latest here?
Well, we may have a problem. They were about to start the tanking of that huge 500,000 gallons of hydrogen and oxygen.
Yes.
At 2:33 Eastern time, which would be 12:33 my time, 11:33 your time. And just before they were to begin, they discovered in their telemetry, because they have incredible computer sophisticated sensors all over this bird, they had a problem potentially with one of the fuel cells.
Now, didn't they have a problem with Discovery with a fuel cell?
I believe so, but we had more.
And they had to replace it
with the fuel level sensor. This is not a sensor problem. This is with the electricity producing fuel cells in the orbiter itself that keep electricity flowing during the 11th
mission. Well, that's a huge problem.
That could be a huge problem. They might be able to do a change out on the pad. In a few minutes, within the next hour, we will know whether they're going to scrub for today and recycle the count, or can recycle the count for tomorrow. They have two more opportunities tomorrow and the next day. In an unprecedented of three in a row, because they really need to get this bird off in the next couple of days so they don't run into the traffic problem with the Soyuz at the space station later in the month.
Well, would they? Okay, so they wouldn't go later? Let's see, if they miss this window, this September 8th window that they have, couldn't they go in a week or two after that?
Then they're dead in the water until late October, October 26th, 27th.
All right, keep us informed, Richard.
Will do.
Thanks. That's Richard C. Hoagland monitoring the plans to launch the space shuttle Atlantis, which is supposed to launch at 12:29 Eastern time. And tomorrow afternoon, but we'll keep our fingers crossed. Richard, this thing is so many delays, huh?
Yeah. Hey, you know, what are the odds, George, that after, if we ever have a kind of disclosure, that we look back on this era of space shuttles and we say, hey, why were we flying these medieval tin cans when we had something, you know, a million times better covertly within in the world of the military?
Well, that's true, too. Are you a believer, and let me ask you very directly, Richard, are you a believer that this planet is indeed being visited? I mean, you've been doing research for all these years.
I am, yes. Okay. I believe that. I believe that this planet is being visited or, let's say, occupied or inhabited, because I'm not sure visiting is really the word that I would choose. I think inhabited by more than one non-human intelligence. That is my belief. Now, I distinguish that from knowledge, but I think that, yes, I mean, based on the different, all the information that I've read, that there are non-human intelligences that are here.
We've got people like you, Stanton Friedman, Kevin Randall, good investigators, Bud Hopkins, David Jacobs, people who have spent really their whole life trying to develop, more information in ufology. Other than Stanton Friedman, I consider your grouping to be really the newer group that's coming from the older group, the J. Allen Hynek's, the Jacques Vallée's, the unfortunate death of John Mack.
Right.
Do you guys have enough, I guess, firepower to keep this going? You know, the old guys seem to have had, I don't know, more, God, what's the word I'm trying to use? I mean, they just seem to have more help from their inside sources. You know, all of us, we're younger now.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the advantage, what's the disadvantage for the new group?
Well, it's a good question. I have some inside sources, and I'm hoping that, in fact, even now, as I speak, that a couple of really important leads that I'm working on will turn out by the time I get my book done. And if not, then they come out when they come out. I think there's definitely a change in attitude between the various generations of UFO researchers. Stan and Bud and David are basically a full generation older than me. I have a tremendous amount of respect for all of those guys, but I do feel that there are differences in how people my age and younger perceive this whole topic, and I think that we're moving this ahead in a productive way. The thing that frustrates me about some of the older researchers is a kind of unwillingness to really look at the dimensions of this, let's call it the conspiracy, the cover-up. They don't really want to go far enough. They all hate guys like Stephen Greer. You know, they call Greer an egomaniac. He's a, you know, spotlight hogger, whatever. That may be true, but a guy like Greer has made one statement that I think is absolutely dead on, and Greer talks about this kind of international corporate private conspiracy that holds this information, and I have, in my own, totally independently, I've come to believe that that's exactly right.
You know, Stephen's supposed to be on with Art this weekend, and you know, originally a few months ago on my program, and then with Art, he talked about these sources within SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
That he believed were out there that talked to him, that provided him information that, you know, we have had signal contact from extraterrestrials. But he wouldn't name names. I like Stephen, by the way. I want to preface all this by saying that. I talked to Seth Shostak, and Seth from SETI said, that's not true. Believe me, if we had signals, we'd be telling the world about it. And you
but
know,
would they?
So, well, I think they would, but we'll find out.
Greer doesn't
weekend.
Give all of his sources. I agree, and that is frustrating.
Well,
it is,
especially then when you get, you know, because I believe in a good conspiracy. Believe me, I do. But there comes a point where you can be conspiratorial with everything in life.
Yes, that is right.
And that's dangerous. And I get to a point where I do believe some of these mainstream scientists, like Shostak, that say, look, we haven't heard a signal. I mean, they're existing to get funding. They'd get more funding if they could hear some signals out there. Believe me, they would.
That's right. That's true. On the other hand, I think I'm with you on 90% of that. I try to be very careful. I mean, I've come to believe in a lot of what you might call conspiracies or cover-ups. I hate to use the word conspiracy, but there you go. But I try to be careful. Hopefully, I come across that way. On the other hand, I do not – there are certain groups out there that I personally do not trust. I don't trust them. I don't trust SETI. Sorry, don't trust them. I feel that their knowledge of UFOs is nil. Shostak knows nothing about UFOs. This guy has been talking about this stuff for years and years, and he hasn't done the most basic homework. Give me a break, man. When he starts talking for real about UFOs and when he has actual knowledge to talk about, I'll start listening to him.
All right, but he'll
as
also
it is right
say
now,
that,
he's talking, giving me hot air.
But he'll also say that's not his area of expertise. I mean, he's been very above board on that. He says, George, I don't concentrate on UFOs. I am looking for signals from outer space. You know, other people say, Seth, it's right under your nose. They're here. But that's he'll be the
right,
first
well,
to
fair
admit
enough,
that he
fair
doesn't
enough.
Do
if
it.
He says he doesn't have a signal, you know, maybe
now,
he doesn't.
Now, with Stephen, you know, if he's on with Art this weekend.
Right.
I would hope that he will name names or do something.
Yeah, we'll see.
You know, because how many years can you continue to talk and nothing happen?
I totally agree. The thing is, it's a tricky situation, and I can appreciate it a little better now than I could have a few years ago when no one knew me at all and no one cared who I was. Now it's like a couple of people care. When you get a source, when someone comes to you in confidence, and if someone is well known and they just can't be compromised, what are you going to do? I mean, I can understand the situation where you don't want to give the game away. I spoke to a very, very senior scientist, big top level guy. Okay, that's all I will say. Who sat me down? This guy knows a couple of U.S. presidents and all of that, and he said, look. I'm not speculating. I'm telling you scientifically as a point of knowledge that, yes, at deep levels, we've got scientists studying alien technology and bodies. Okay, fine. He says, now, let's pretend that I have a list of 15 people who absolutely have got all the goods on this. All right, I know who they are. What do I do with such a list? Do I bring it to the New York Times? Well, if I do, are they going to publish it?
You bring it to us, Richard. You bring it to you. You bring it to us. We get it on this program, and then everybody will wake up.
Right. But if so, then what happens? Then the leak is known. Then this guy's cut out of his information. And then he's, you know, and then he's out. And then, of course, it's information that would be utterly deniable. And so you're back at the drawing board. And so these people, there are people who are trying to navigate their way through this secrecy, and they're trying to protect themselves while they do it. I'm on the side of getting this information out, and I believe that by the time I'm all done with this, I'll have everything that I'm researching is going to be out. I'm not holding anything back.
Yeah, but you're meticulous. You're forthright. You put out as much information as you can, and I think that's critical to this investigation,
yeah,
because I got to tell you, I talked in 1997. I was talking with Stephen Bassett, who at that time was working as a lobbyist for Greer, and he told me, so that's 9 years ago, he says, we're coming out with a full-page ad in the New York Times,
yeah.
Or was it the Wall Street Journal, one of those newspapers?
Yes.
We're
going
to have a list of 50 to 75 signatures of major people. None of this ever happens.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in every year you interview people and you say, how close are we coming to full disclosure? And it's always, it's going to happen. It's going to be
close. Exactly. You know, Stephen is a very good friend of mine, Stephen Bassett, and I love him like a brother. And he's
and I would tell him this to his face, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I have.
Well, so have I. I said to him, look, you believe, and it's not just him, that disclosure is going to happen any minute. And you know what? One of the things that I'm dealing with in my next book is this theme, because this is a recurring theme in UFO studies. I mean, it went back to the 50s, in fact, and through the 60s, and in the 70s. I talked about the Freedom of Information Act. Back in the late 70s, people thought, okay, it's going to happen anytime. We're going to break it open. Well, it didn't happen. But then in the late 80s, with the revelations with George Knapp and Bob Lazar at Area 51 and all the other leaks, because that wasn't the only leak coming out of that, out of Nevada. Lots of people were talking, and there were many people who believed in the UFO research community, like circa 1990, that there was going to be a major disclosure any time now. It was going to happen, And it did not happen. And then you get the election of Bill Clinton. A lot of people felt, well, now we've got a guy who's a little more liberal on freedom of information. In fact, there was the initiative by the late Lawrence Rockefeller. Many people remember this.
Yes, God rest his soul.
That's right, to try to open up UFO data on that front. And that it looked like it might get some momentum for a while, and that ended up in the horrifically bad Air Force report on Roswell, mogul balloon and crash test dummies and all that stuff. That went nowhere. And then you get Greer hitting the scene with his stuff in the late 90s and disclosure and all of this, culminating his press conference of 2001, and that didn't happen. And it still keeps going. We're at a point where we keep thinking it's going to happen. The thing that keeps me thinking that it will happen is that we live in an incredibly volatile point in our society right now, where change is so dramatic that it seems to me that as a civilization, we're going to have a need for disclosure, as opposed to, say, 1960. And here's why. Like, go back 45, 50 years, and again, let's say that we're secret keepers and we know about this stuff. So we're thinking, well, if we give the secret out, not only will we have the mass panic and all these other disruptions occurring in our society, but we may be out of a job.
Well, let me ask you, Richard, yeah. We're coming to the break, but yeah. Do you really believe a government would prosecute someone who goes public and says, we're being visited by UFOs, here are the pictures, and I don't think they will. I think there'd be too much of a public outcry. This guy would be a hero. They might even give him a ticker tape parade through Wall Street or someplace like that.
Well, maybe we'll have to debate that over after the break. I don't know, maybe.
Let's
maybe
debate
not.
That after the break. But we need that individual who's got the guts to do this.
But a lot of that information is locked away in special access programs, and we don't even have access to those. So I don't know.
All right, stay with us. Richard yeah. Dolan, we'll talk with you about that. Then let's talk about your television-related show when we're back on Coast to Coast AM. So, Richard, let's talk a little bit about, and then we'll get back to our debate here. You're working on a television show, I hear?
Yes.
Tell me.
Yes, I am. It's been the thing that has, that in my book, has monopolized my summer. And has been a lot of fun, too. So this is a show that will air on the Sci-Fi Channel on October 11th, and this is going to be called Sci-Fi Investigates. And basically, it investigates the paranormal. So this is a 6-episode pilot so it starts on October 11th, and it's an hour, and it will go for 6 weeks until it's done. And hey, if ratings are good, they'll pick it up, they'll do some more, and if not, well, then it's been fun anyway.
Super. Well, good luck on that, and if we can help you in any way, let me know.
Sure,
all right,
sure.
That's great. Just to publicize it when it's on, let us know.
Well, I have to tell you, it's a kind of a neat show. When I first was asked to do it, I had this idea that it was going to be kind of like a In Search Of sort of straight-up documentary, and it isn't. It's not that at all. I'm a host/investigator, and there are three other host/investigators. We each have a different kind of perspective that we bring to looking into all the weird stuff that goes on in the world, whether it's UFOs or ghosts or life after death or voodoo or Bigfoot. We've done shows on all of those things. So I'm billed as the paranormal investigator. Then there's an archaeologist. In fact, some listeners may know who Bill Dolman is. Bill led an archaeological dig of the Roswell site a couple of years ago.
Right. And that was, that's right. It was on video.
Back on for this. There's a crime scene investigator, a lady who works for the state of Connecticut named Deb DeBrittany. She's really smart, really cool person. And then we have the skeptic, who's kind of like the everyman. And this guy is actually very well known. He has millions of fans from when he was on the show Survivor. I never watched Survivor, but a lot of people remember him. He's the Boston Red Sox fanatic who wears his cap all the time, and his name is Rob Mariano, otherwise known as Boston Rob. When I first met Rob, I thought, I got to work with this guy.
Yeah,
what am I doing here, man? But I have to say, I really, he and I get along just fine off camera, and on camera we mix it up constantly. So what we go into, we do serious investigation of various events. And then really the show is about that investigation, but it's also a little bit about our take on each other. And so I think it's interesting in that regard. It's nothing like anything I've done before. I will say I've had the time of my life doing the shoot, and I'm so glad I've been involved in
working with it. I was going to say, how many of the episodes are done?
Well, we filmed five. We're actually going to film the sixth one next weekend in New York City, and that will be the show on Life After Death. The sci-fi.com is about to put up a link, a lot of information on this. They have not yet done it. I'm told it's going to happen any day. When that comes on, I'll have a link to it from my website as well so people can check it out. I'm excited about it, actually. I never really thought I would do a TV show at all, much less one like this. But it's produced by NBC. It's not produced just by sci-fi.
Okay.
NBC owns sci-fi.
Yeah.
So they've got very professional people working on it, and it's what I've seen so far looks kind of cool.
Any surprises, Richard?
Yeah, well, we did a re-investigation of the Roswell dig, a kind of a new Roswell dig. That was somewhat interesting, but what was very interesting for me is I got to interview a new witness who's no one has ever talked to this guy on camera before. This is a first for television, a man in his 80s who says that he saw dead alien bodies. And this guy's on camera, and it was an interesting interview for me. And I got to say, the guy certainly seems very credible in my opinion. We did a really interesting show on UFO hotspots dealing with Dulce, New Mexico, and the whole question of the underground base that is said by some to be at Mount Archuleta at Dulce. I'm looking forward to seeing how that will be on TV because I think that came over very well. And we did a kind of funky, cool show on voodoo, which I did a voodoo dance at midnight in New Orleans holding a snake over my head with this super cool voodoo rock and roll priestess. So, like, you know, man, I just, like, I had the time of my life. And
well, I tell you, it's real.
I went native on voodoo, George. I went native. I said, I'm signing up.
Do you feel comfortable with it, with voodoo?
I do, yes. I had no true knowledge of voodoo before going in.
You know, I talked to someone from Haiti a couple of years ago whose mother is a practitioner of voodoo, and he said that mainstream media has blown it out of proportion, has turned it into evil.
I think that's right.
And Hollywood has turned it into evil.
Totally. The thing is, you can't. What I learned is that you can't study voodoo from the outside. If you really want to look at voodoo, you got to go in, and that means you got to do it. And if you start practicing it, you're going to get to a point where you have that moment where you think, oh, my God, that thing just worked. And then you become a believer. I did an interview with a woman named Martha Ward, a professor at the University of New Orleans, seasoned academic, PhD. She's published throughout the world. And when I went to talk with her, I was expecting her to give the standard academic, you know, be sympathetic to voodoo, but I didn't think that she would believe in voodoo. Not only does she believe in the magic of voodoo, she said to me, hey, listen, the reason you got to wear white at this particular ritual is so that when the loa come down, that is the spirits come down to inhabit you, they can see you more easily. I mean, she's like 60 years old. She's been doing this for years and years and years. So in other words, you start getting in, and it's very difficult. And I spoke with many other people, very, very articulate, very rational, scientifically minded people, down there, and you ask them about voodoo, and they are total believers. So, yeah, it was a fascinating experience for me.
Well, good for you. I hope this works well.
Yeah, the show's been fun. So, October 11th, go to sci-fi.com. I think it airs at 10 o'clock, and it follows Ghost Hunters.
And we've had the Ghost Hunters on the program before.
Ah, yes. I thought so.
Good. We've got a good relationship with sci-fi.
Yeah, so. Well, we're going to follow them. We're coming on at 10 o'clock that night, so... keep your fingers crossed, and if you're listening to this, guys, anyone is interested, go check it out. I don't know what the first episode is going to be. Sci-fi is keeping it, they're keeping their options open.
Bit. Sure.
So I'm just as much in the dark as anyone else. But that's been my project. It's been a fun. It's taken a lot of my time. I mean, the thing is, I'm trying to get this book of mine done. The next book, which has been sitting over my head for 5 years, and it's moving. I've got a number of readers who've been reading some of my chapters, and they're giving me good feedback.
In this world of Photoshop, you know, one can manipulate and come up with pictures, where in the past you really couldn't do that.
Yeah, that's right. That's a real issue.
Yeah,
it's a real issue. On the other hand, here's what I say about that. And we have to finish our debate on the secrecy, too, because I've been thinking about it.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing with the photographs, like there are a number of UFO websites that have photographs or alleged, let's say alleged photographs. There's one that I like a lot, the website called UFOcasebook.com. And it seems to me that they've got a very, very good selection of UFO photographs from the current year right on back to the 19th century. And they're nicely organized. One thing that I notice when I review recent UFO photographs, they're all taken with digital cameras, of course. Everyone's got digital. Some of them are taken with cell phone cameras, okay? But there is, in fact, when you really look at them, certain very fundamental types of objects that are being captured on film, not on film, digitally. And it's not that you can't analyze a digital photograph. You actually can. It's just harder. I mean, you can study the pixelation at a very, very fine degree. And, yes, a master at Photoshop can make probably a pretty good fake. But the question is, George, I mean, are all of these people master Photoshop experts?
No, they can't be.
No, I don't think so. And a number of these pictures have been studied and investigated in the sense that the people who took the photograph were known people. Like there's a good photograph from 2004 from Australia taken by a highway inspector type guy for his local municipality. And he took a picture of an intersection. There's a railroad tracks there, and he didn't even see it when he took the shot. But there's this object in the top right part of the corner. Classic flying saucer, slightly blurred around the edges. They're all that way. I happen to think that the reason they're blurred is because they emit a kind of field that does this. This is actually what I believe is the case. But these objects, they all look the same. Now, unless he photoshopped it the same way that everyone else did, but no one's seeing this. I mean, people are studying some of these digital photographs, and I'm not seeing too many of these being actually faked. So I think that there is, in fact, a lot of photographic evidence that is out there, and that looks to me to be good evidence. I agree with you that each one individually can't really amount to a whole lot, but I'm also impressed by the sheer quantity and consistency of many. We're talking hundreds of photographs. I mean, back in 1955, if you had like five UFO photographs for the year, you're like, wow, great. Now there are hundreds every year that are out there on the net. I was just looking at one the other day taken in China by a guy with a cell phone camera. I don't know what this thing was, there's a picture actually of the cell phone showing the image.
Yeah.
It's this very, very bizarre light phenomenon in the sky. I've never seen anything like it. I don't know what it was. I don't think it was photoshopped. I mean, I'm looking at the cell phone.
Oh, heck, those cameras though are lousy, aren't they?
Yeah, well, they're getting better, though.
Yeah, but
They're all getting better. So the point is simply, it can be faked. But simply because they can be faked, I think it's a very, very big mistake. It's foolhardy to say that we can't accept any of this as evidence because this is the world we live in. Everyone's got digital cameras, and we have to just be vigilant when we look at these and yes, not accept everything as gospel, but let's also keep it open that some of these are very possibly what people say they are. Now, I want to take your point about the inevitability of leaks. I happen to agree with you on this. The fact is, George, that leaks on UFO secrecy dealing with bodies and technology have been coming steady, at a steady pace for decades. Back in the late 70s, one UFO researcher, Leonard Stringfield, started to make it his kind of niche in UFO research to collect sources and leaks.
Right. He was one of the best. He was out of Cincinnati, Ohio, if I remember.
Exactly right. Yeah. He's passed away for the last 10 years or so. I never had the pleasure to meet him. But Mr. Stringfield was a former military himself, was a guy of real integrity who apparently people really trusted him a lot, and they started to come to him. He'd written a book in the late 70s that dealt a little bit, only a little bit, with the theme of crash retrievals, only peripherally. But it seems that sparked a lot of people who trusted him and came to him from the military. And he developed over the next decade, several dozen firsthand and several more dozen secondhand sources, that is intermediaries, like someone would say, you know, my husband doesn't want to talk to you, but this is his story. And then other people who spoke directly. So there have been a lot of leaks. You get leaks. The late Senator Barry Goldwater has said a number of times when he was alive about his failed attempts to go into the so-called Blue Room at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where there are rumors of alien bodies. Astronaut Edgar Mitchell, a moonwalking astronaut of Apollo 14, has said publicly for 10 years, and he said to me privately, but he said publicly, that he has two ultra-elite sources who have told him, confirmed to him, of the existence of deep black programs to study alien technology and bodies. This is a moonwalking astronaut. Even if he's wrong, where is the media here dealing with this news story? This is a major, major news story. You've got one of the most famous people in the world with real access to important people saying that they're telling him about alien technology. And where's CBS News here? I mean, really.
That's true. You know, and Edgar said on this program, he believes in extraterrestrial life. He believes we've been visited.
Well,
and he did say he didn't see anything on the moon when he was with Apollo 14, but he did say that he believes that we've been visited.
Well, beyond belief, though, what he's also said is that he had serious conversations with two distinct people who came from totally different perspectives, but within the highly classified world, who told him of these programs to study alien technology. Now, that's secondhand, but this is also Edgar Mitchell we're talking about, and I have to assume that you're a moonwalking astronaut. You can have some pretty elite friends who've got some serious things to say, and Mitchell is saying this. My point is simply, where is mainstream media? Because it's one thing to say you believe in extraterrestrials. It's quite another to say that you've got major sources telling you about secret alien technology programs. I mean, there's more leaks. There's the statements by Ben Rich, formerly of Lockheed Skunk Works, who ran that very elite unit for many, many years. Ben Rich, toward the end of his life, this is in the late 80s and 90s, spoke on a number of occasions about that we now have, as he said, the technology to take E.T. home. We know how to travel to the stars. Ben Rich said this at UCLA School of Engineering in 1993, gave a speech. I know one of the attendees of that speech. And he basically said, look, there are many in the intelligence community who would like us all to stay in the black and not see the light of day. But toward the end of his life, Ben Rich felt that he wanted to discuss this on a limited basis to a kind of a controlled audience. This was just a small group at UCLA. He wasn't talking to media. But the leaks do occur. There was a real bombshell that came out just a couple of years ago from a former Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, that is Catherine Austin Fitz. And she was the Assistant Secretary of HUD during the presidency of George Bush Sr. And Catherine Fitz, people can go to her website and look this up. I mean, I'm not making it up here. She talked about a meeting she had in 1998 with John Peterson, who was head of the Arlington Institute. And John Peterson, by the way, was a friend of James Woolsey, former head of CIA. Woolsey has his own thing with UFOs in this history. But Catherine said, she said, I met with, this is in 1998, that she met with a group of high-level people in the military, including the undersecretary of the, I think she said of the Navy. But she said, according to Peterson, the purpose of the plan was to help the Navy adjust their operations for a world in which it was commonly known that aliens exist and live among us. And then, I mean, as if that wasn't enough, she said that John Peterson asked her if she would like to meet some aliens.
Oh, get him on this program, Richard.
Peterson, yes. Well, people have asked Peterson about this, and he won't issue a comment. He's like, no, he won't talk
about it. See, that's part of the problem. Stay with us, Richard. We're going to be back in a moment. I want to get your take on Colonel Philip Corso, the late Colonel Corso. And then we'll take phone calls as well. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Now with Richard Dolan, then your phone calls. Richard, Bill Burns is a co-author with me in my book, Worker in the Light, and I trust him. And he co-wrote the book The Day After Roswell with Colonel Philip Corso.
Right.
Bill Burns believes Corso's story. I don't know if Corso's story is real or not, but Bill Burns believes it, and I trust Bill Burns. So what's your take?
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned this, because ever since that Corso's book came out, which was, I think, in 1997, I've just been, like a lot of researchers, thinking he makes a lot of claims in there. They're not really verifiable. I will say this. I think that the critics of Corso often, I hate to criticize even people I like, such as Stan Friedman, but I think that they lack a certain level of objectivity when they go after Corso. And some of the other critics of Corso, in attacking him, calling him a fraud, I think are way over the top. I don't see this with Corso. The other thing I can tell you is that just various sources that I have who talk to me about this tell me that they know absolutely for sure that Corso was fundamentally telling the truth. That doesn't, you know, what does that matter? But my feeling is that, I mean, there's a lot of mistakes in Corso's book. He was in his 80s when he wrote it. This is the day after Roswell. For anyone who's not familiar, I mean, the base bare bones is that he said he was part of a very select, basically, team in 1960-61 to pass off acquired alien technology to American corporations for research and development, and to kind of pass off the technology. He also said that at Fort Riley, Kansas, in 1947, he happened to see an alien body that was in transport on the way, I think, to Wright-Patterson. So that's a pretty big thing to say. The thing about Corso, though, is that this is a guy who has real life credentials. And a number of people said, no, those credentials don't check out. I don't think that's true. I think his credentials do check out. And the more that I look into Corso, because I was at a point even 5 years ago where I thought, well, I'm not going to really take this very seriously. I now believe that Corso's story is probably fundamentally correct and probably fundamentally true. I do think that the book was rushed in to be released for the 50th anniversary of the Roswell event. In other words, in 1997, there was a huge rush to get this out because I think it would just help book sales. I'm sure it did, but that book needed some more editing. So really, it was rushed out, and I think it should have, in the best of all worlds, it should have gone through some more fact-checking, because there were a number of things that he mentioned, I can't even remember offhand, but there were like very easily identifiable factual errors. One person said to me that, in fact, when Corso was pointed out, when someone mentioned a Corso, like, did you really say that? Apparently his response was, what? I said that? I couldn't have said that. So I think a lot of the book was just sloppy, but that's a different thing from saying that it was fraudulent. And I don't believe. I mean, Corso was a junior member. He was attached to the National Security Council under Eisenhower. People said, no, you weren't a member of the National Security Council. Friedman, for example, mentioned this, and other people do too.
Right.
But he wasn't a member of the NSC staff, but he was attached to it as a junior military officer. He was. He wasn't lying about that. People said, no, you only ran the foreign technology desk for 90 days in the year 1961. In fact, he ran it for 2 years. But when you look at the military records, it isn't immediately clear. It's true. But Corso did run foreign technology desk for 2 years. So when you look at some of these things more closely, I think Corso does check out much more than people realize. So I happen to think, yeah, I mean...
So what percent would you say would be accurate? I mean, if he were to fabricate part of it, he'd fabricate most of it.
Well, right. I don't think he fabricated any of it. I don't think any of it is intentional fabrication.
Okay.
That's my feeling. I don't think that he would do that. That doesn't seem like Corso's history. I mean, he had a history even prior to this as a whistleblower and as an accurate one. He wasn't just some guy who came out of nowhere. So my sense is, the real issue isn't did he pass off technology to industry. To me, that's not that controversial and not that difficult to fathom. The real question that I have is, did he see an alien body in 1947? That's a hard thing to just misremember. I can't, you know, I'm thinking, if I were a 20-something-year-old soldier and I open up a crate and I'm looking at an alien body, I'm not soon to forget that.
No, far from.
And I'm not soon to make a mistake. I mean, if it's an alien, I think I can identify it, and I assume Corso did. So that's the real issue. And he says he did it. Honestly, George, my heart of hearts, I think he's telling the truth.
Yeah, I did too. As incredible as the story is.
Now, yeah, the problem is, like, when certain people latch onto it as like, this is the proof. I mean, I can't consider Corso anything like proof. I spoke at the Toronto conference a year ago with former Minister of Defense of Canada, Paul Hellyer. Hellyer got a lot of press because this is a guy who ran Canada's military for a couple of years, in the 60s, and he's talking about UFOs. That was great. One thing Hellyer said at that conference was that one of the things that turned him around was Corso's book. I happened to be sitting next to Stanton Friedman during that whole speech, and Stanton was just groaning the whole time. He was just miserable, and he's thinking, oh, why is Hellyer bringing up Corso? But I think that Corso, I think he's more legitimate than people tend to give him credit for being, although in a public venue, I consider Corso damaged goods, and just because there's been so much controversy about him. So I don't think you'd be wise to use him as your first line of argument.
Yeah, I think Bill's got some further notes that Corso took. So, you know, there may be a part two coming up here.
Yes, I think that there is a further story. And indeed, the family of Philip Corso Jr. has spoken publicly a number of times. And so, yeah, there's more to say on this. But, you know, the real issue is, I mean, my God, George, we're so lucky we got a guy like you doing the radio, because there aren't that many other venues for people like us to talk about these things. Where is the mainstream media here to give these stories the kind of scope that they truly deserve?
True, and let's give Art Bell the credit for being the pioneer in all this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without him, you know, pushing this, when people, you know, thought he was crazy, you know, and nuts, this never would have happened.
He deserves a tremendous amount of credit for that. I totally agree.
Let's go to the phones. They've been waiting for you, Richard.
Wow.
East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Deborah. Hi, Richard. Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi, Deborah.
I have more of a comment than anything else, and that would be, to me, the government is going to do what they're going to do. There's proof every day that there are things that we just definitely don't know about. Now, I'm an abductee. It happened to me in 73, and what I believe, and I'm wondering what the audience would think about this, is the average person, it seems like their frequency and their concepts are stuck. They're like they're stuck in the mud, for lack of better words. And myself, being a human being who was abducted, it took me about 10 years or more, and then all of a sudden I realized that my frequency level as a person, being psychic and being an artist, everything seemed to be bumped up. And
Deborah, you think that the experience you had actually triggered something in you to bring you to another level?
Yes, I do, and I'm grateful for it.
Wow.
That's what I think. And as far, like I said, as far as the government goes, we know they hide things every single day. CBS is not going to go on TV and say, oh, yes, there are aliens, and yes, it takes all these books because the average person needs proof. I don't need proof. It happened.
Well, listen, I think I take your point very well. I would quibble with one thing, which is that there's a strong tendency for people to say, well, it doesn't really matter what the government does. We don't need the government to know what's true. And I agree with that. We don't need the government to validate what we know to be true. However, last time I checked, we were supposed to be living in a Republican, democratic system of government in which power devolved to the people. So that, in other words, so that the government is supposed to be responsive to us, all right? And if we as a society have this major phenomenon that we are interacting with every day, and we can't get a responsible government response to this, then we've got a real problem, all right? This is a phenomenon that involves massively powerful technology by entities unknown for purposes unknown that most people, by the way, are dealing with totally atomized, cut off from other people, okay? So where's our coordinated response? Well, it's supposed to be from our government. Now, maybe our government is responding in a way and, you know, they're keeping it secret. But you know what? Look, we're not 5 years old. This is my point. I think we're grown up enough, and we're in a situation where I think the events in the world around us may force us to be a little more upfront about this. I mean, I don't think we should just be sitting on our ducks all day waiting for Big Brother to tell us when they're going to let us know. I'm not sure I feel very comfortable with that.
Okay, let's pick up next. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yes, I have a question. And, okay, it started like when I was really little. Mm-hmm. Probably me and my sister, probably like when we were like in grade school, maybe second, third grade.
Yes.
Okay, me and my sister would play in the backyard, and something got a hold. I saw this, like, it was like a disc-like thing. And then I saw my sister levitate, and she disappeared, right? Well, when I turn around, you know, my sister here, she comes out of the bushes, and my sister was abducted, and I believe I was abducted as well because that happened, and then I was with a friend. I was coming home, and there was the moon. It was like it turned to like it was like two moons in one. Well, it took a snapshot, like a picture when you take a picture, you know, the flash. It went to a flash, and then, like, as my eyes was adjusting, it turned bright red. You know what I'm saying?
Were you much older at this point? You weren't a child.
This was like way after when I was a little kid, when that one experience happened.
Right, the first one. But the second one.
The second one was like 3 years ago.
Okay,
I'm 34.
Okay.
Okay, and then me and my sister, we'd be outside, and we've witnessed a lot of things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I like to know also, we see ships, okay, and we have seen aliens, but they look like spiders.
What do you mean they look like spiders?
Well, like, I don't know. It was like a crazy form.
You could see them in the ship windows or something?
Did you see these in bed when you were sleeping?
No, we'd be outside in the dark. Because me and her, we go outside and we explore to see ships. You know, because we go outside and I mean, the different kinds of UFOs and spaceships that we see is like phenomenal.
Well, if I were you, I'd be living with a camcorder attached to my hip at all times.
All times. I want to know about these spider beans.
The spider beans? I don't know. It's crazy. It's really hard to describe. And I've read a lot of things. And
how many legs do they have? Eight legs? Six
yeah,
legs?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And it might sound crazy, but like
yeah,
like it was like different. You know, like different types of forms. Like they were formed crazy.
They shape shifted on you?
Something like that. Yeah, it's hard to explain. And
have you talked to many like family about this? What do they think about it?
No, me and my sister, pretty much, they're pretty close-minded.
The family is.
Yeah, because when my sister was abducted and she came back, you know, because like it, you know, she like I couldn't even like. If there was a wall blocking her, you know, it was like she was hypnotized to this. You know, and she just, but it was crazy because when she came back down, her two pinkies were like if there was skin grown underneath it and her pinkies like if they were broken. You know what I'm saying? We went in and I remember we telling our mother this. And my mother tried to sit there and say, no, you were born like that. And when I know well, she was not born like that. And I looked at my mom.
Well, wouldn't your mother know?
You know what? I told my mother that Rosemary's fingers has always been, and I tried to recorrect her, and I got into really big trouble. you know, because my mom didn't believe. They're very close-minded.
Well, I don't know. Richard, we're coming up to the break here.
Yeah, but the thing is...
I don't know what you could recommend for her.
It's a story that's so out there. Look, I've heard a lot of crazy stories. I don't think yours is crazy necessarily, but it's so far out that you have to do the best you can to verify it. So if you're able to have a camcorder, do things like this, you got to record it. If you see multiple UFOs, a lot of people who have seen multiple UFOs, you find out that they often discover that they may have been abducted.
This could have been the praying mantis figures, too, that she's seen. I mean, they look like spiny.
I no longer dismiss really outlandish stories immediately. I've learned to realize that.
All right, stay with us. Richard Dawn on our guest. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Richard, before we go back to final calls, tell us how people can learn more about you and your work.
Sure. Thank you, George. I have a website. It is keyholepublishing.com, just like looking through a keyhole, keyholepublishing.com. And that's got it's got about 40 pages of my first book up online. You can just read the whole introduction, some various chapter segments, a bunch of articles that I've written, updates on what I'm doing these days. And so it's probably the best good place to start.
By the way, anybody listening to us on our number one station in Seattle, KVI, which I'll, of course, be out there for a book signing sometime in October, they're getting double audio. So engineer there, get there and fix it quickly. I'm getting hundreds of emails from people saying, help us.
Hey, I'm getting emails during our interview here, George, from some like really interesting people.
Oh, of course.
One person is telling me, who's working down at Cape Canaveral in the 60s during the Apollo missions, talking about ET UFO sightings down at Cape Canaveral. During that, I need to correspond with this person a little bit more to get some details, but he seems very on the level. Another person who talks about how her husband, and she knew an Air Force colonel at Edwards Air Force Base, who offhandedly at a social event, this is your thing about you can't keep leaks secrets.
That's right.
There are alien bodies in a freezer over at Edwards, and said that our military had developed antimatter weapons. This is in the mid 1980s. She said, "I've never forgotten it."
I love it.
So there's evidence going back through the 1980s that we've had some really exotic technology that we have developed. There's an aerospace journalist, James Goodall, who developed some contacts at that time, and one of his Area 51 contact said to him, this is almost a famous quote in the field now, he said, we have technology that would make George Lucas envious. We have stuff in the Nevada desert, he said, that would make George Lucas envious. Back mid-1980s.
Back to the phones. First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Steve calling from Los Angeles, George.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Oh, I'm so glad to be on. I just want to tell you real quickly, I just started listening here. My friend's listened for years. I started listening in July. And I haven't missed a show since.
Great. Thank you.
And what I've got to tell everyone right now is just, it's just what everyone needs to hear. Everyone's talking about proof of UFOs, and I keep hearing this proof. So I'm a scientific person. I studied astronomy at UCLA in 1961, and I followed the space program closely. And listen to this. James McDivitt is on a show one night. I can't tell you what the show is, but he's on his mission. He's looking out the window, and he sees a cylindrical object with an appendage coming out the side.
Right.
And he takes it with two Hasselblad cameras, the picture. And when he gets back to Houston, this is when they're based in Houston, he goes in to find out about the pictures and say, oh, we don't have any pictures like that. So, you know, that was that on that show. And then this is months later, and you're going to have to look into what TV station it was. I think it was Channel 11, and I'm not sure of the year, but you see about the time frame I'm talking about. And NASA, this is a NASA-produced program. At the top of the show, they say some people may not be ready for what they're about to see, and they just want to warn everybody. And here's what I want to tell, and here's what it's gone lost somehow. NASA showed and admitted that every single flight to the moon, every flight to the moon, there and back, was accompanied by a physical or nebulous object. And then here's the one by one, and here they start to say James McDivitt, and you know, my eyes get real big. And there it is, just like you said, a cylindrical object like a can with an appendage coming out the side.
Fascinating. And, of course, we all are aware of Buzz Aldrin's recent statement that he said, you know, on the Apollo 11 mission, on the way out there,
right.
we were followed by an object we could not identify.
Right. But NASA seems to be, or no one seems to know about this show. They showed them all. I made notes on the show.
You know, I don't know about it.
Yeah, this
I don't know about it.
And I got some other astounding facts here, but that show needs to be dug up, and you know that needs to be brought to some of these seminars coming up here. Especially
I'm taking
the one
notes as you speak. I'm going to try to hunt that down. I'll try to talk to some
absolutely
people.
Absolutely, you know, if I come across my notes.
What period of time did it show? Did you say the '70s,
'80s? I'm not sure when James McDivitt's flight was, but
well, that was in the '60s. Yeah.
Okay. So this show is in the late 70s or early 80s.
Okay.
Here's something that's just going to blow everyone's mind. You know, I'm a scientific student. Like I said, I got Scientific American, and the January Scientific American in the category Science and the Citizen, there's an article in there. I've got a copy of it. It's called Kicking the Gong. Now, this is January 1970. So this is covering the flight, first landing on the moon. And when they blasted back off the moon, you know, with the LEM and docked with the command module, they jettisoned the rocket and the LEM back to the moon to calibrate the seismometer they left there. And here's what happened. The article's called Kicking the Gong. The moon reverberated and resonated for 56 minutes. It increased in resonance for like 9 minutes and took another 50-something minutes to stop ringing.
Yeah.
That's in Scientific American.
Some people say that means the moon is hollow. What is George? Do you know about this idea of the hollow moon theory and the moon ringing like a bell?
Yeah, there have been some people who have theorized that the moon is artificial,
right?
And that, of course, what we see are millions and millions of years of just caked up problems, getting hit by meteors and asteroids that make the crater look on the moon.
Because I've heard too that the moon rings like a bell.
But it may, but I don't think it's artificial. I think the moon broke off from good old planet Earth.
Yeah,
also, might have been part of whatever object collided with us.
That seems certainly much more realistic.
That's the thing. There's a lot of great mysteries in this universe.
Yeah, it really is.
But let's not get too far-fetched here. And I don't think the moon is artificial.
Right.
Or towed in.
But the damn thing rings like a bell, though.
East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Oh, yeah. My name's Mike. I'm in Houston, Texas.
Yes, Mike.
I wanted to let you know that back in the late 60s, I was living in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I met this lady and was talking to her and found out her husband had transferred from Washington, D.C. So I asked her what she did in Washington. She said, oh, I worked at the Pentagon. I said, oh, really? I said, what'd you do? She said, I worked on Project Blue Book. I said, oh, how cool.
I like that.
I said, what can you tell me? She said, well, she said, I can't tell you anything except this. What they have would scare the hell out of you. And she said, I can't go beyond that, so don't ask me.
Wow.
And that's really all I wanted to share with you tonight.
And those were her exact words, huh?
Yeah. What they have would scare the hell out of her exact words.
Mm-hmm. You know what's amazing is that the Blue Book records are pretty much public domain at this point. I mean, anyone can go in and read them. And the Blue Book reports are, they're kind of interesting, but they're not that overly dramatic. A few of them are. So a lot of people have really speculated that there are secret Blue Book files. I really wonder if that's what she's referring to.
Well, maybe so. What would they mean, though, scare the hell out of you? What could be so scary?
Well, it would be kind of scary to someone who's gone their whole life not believing in aliens to think that there's, a non-human intelligence kind of zipping around our skies. I mean, that's kind of scary. Or if you were to learn that they were, even in the mid-60s, abducting people or doing tests or...
And we could stop it.
And we couldn't stop it. Or if they lived here underground permanently. I mean, all of those things are pretty scary. I mean, to lots of people. I guess I'm kind of used to it at this point in my life, but... I meet people all the time, even today. They find out that I'm a UFO writer. They start talking to me. And every now and then, I'll run into someone who gets really creeped out by it. And they just don't want to deal with it. So there's a lot of people out there who still have that kind of reaction.
Okay, next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi.
George. Hi, this is Mary Michael. I'm sorry, I have a cold tonight.
Well, you
sound great, though.
Thank you.
That's all right.
I was just going to say, I was just listening to the last caller, and maybe what they're scared to death about is the rumor about Sikton and how the aliens made us, which would throw God off.
Right, the rumor about what was the first part?
Yeah, but somebody had to make them, Mary Michael.
Exactly. Now, I do believe in God, but that wasn't really what I was calling about. But, you know, that would be scary to a lot of, to my parents, you know. And
sure.
I just believe that God made whatever. Mm-hmm. He was the beginning, and we were all with him. But what I called about was I saw a show on Larry King a couple of years ago with Jimmy Carter on, and he had said, you know, when he was running, he had said that he was going to disclose Blue Book and let the American people
right.
know. And he tried, and Big Bush, that's who I call, you know, Big Bush, President Bush, the first one, hadn't been in office yet, but wasn't he in the CIA or something?
He'd been director of the CIA.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no, not under Carter's administration.
No, but the prior year under Gerald Ford.
Right.
Yeah.
And Carter went to him and said, I want all this information. And he said, even though Carter was president of the United States, talk about shadow governments, Bush wouldn't give it to him.
Right. That's I'm sure that's true. Did Carter say that on the Larry King show?
Yeah, I was going to say, did he say that?
No, he did not say that on the Larry King show.
Well, where did it come from?
I heard that before, and I'd read about it.
Rumors. I never heard that.
Yeah, I've heard this one. Yeah.
Richard, did you hear that he used that?
Well, he's my father's third cousin.
Specifically?
Well, yeah. What the rumor actually derives from conversations between attorney Daniel Sheehan and a friend of his, Marcia Smith, who worked at the Library of Congress, and apparently this is what she told to him. She told him. She apparently knew this.
Hearsay, Richard. Hearsay. We want proof.
Well, look, I'm just telling you, man, where the story comes from. I think it probably happened. Carter did get briefed by Bush. We know that this happened prior to taking the office. They did meet. George Bush wrote about it in his memoirs and, in fact, described Carter's attitude very hostile to CIA and so forth. Bush did take Carter and Walter Mondale, vice president-elect, aside for a specialized briefing, apart from all the other CIA people there. This was at Carter's home. So they did have a briefing, and there is reason to think that Carter did ask Bush about UFO information and that Bush basically said no. Carter did campaign about and did deal with the UFO issue as a candidate.
But kind of clammed up after he got elected.
He did
what
he did. Carter, I got to give this man some credit. For the first year of his presidency, he genuinely tried, to some extent, he tried to kind of get NASA to take the UFO problem and to sort of become a new version of Blue Book. And NASA, with the CIA standing right behind them, said absolutely no way, and they just fought Carter tooth and nail, and they ended up winning.
The old embassy takeover was his undoing.
But Carter was interested, and as a candidate did talk about UFOs. It was a unique thing. I mean, really, there aren't any other U.S. presidential candidates who talked about UFOs while they were running for office.
But didn't Bill Clinton, once he got elected, didn't he try to find out what was going on?
Clinton did. Clinton was interested in UFOs. So was Ronald Reagan, by the way. Ronald Reagan was almost obsessed by UFOs.
Well, I know Ronald Reagan's son, Michael. And he told me that his dad had seen one over the old ranch and wanted to get to the bottom of it, but apparently never did, or at least that's what Michael says.
Yeah, there are several Reagan UFO stories, as a matter of fact. But Clinton, I think, was interested. Jimmy Carter, though, certainly was. And as far as that meeting with Bush, it is hearsay, but I find it at least plausible.
Yeah, but, I mean, here again...
But what's your problem with it, George? I mean, why is it so difficult to believe?
Well, it's not a matter of difficult to believe. It's just that there's no proof.
No, exactly.
Look, I'm a newsman, you know, and I will report on stories all day long. But, you know, it would be nice to get some hard evidence once
in a while. And Marcia Smith, the source of the story, from what I'm hearing, she's really not talking to people. So.
And I think people want hard evidence now. I think they're waiting for it. I think they're anxious for it.
Absolutely. We need to be striving for it at all times. I'm with you on that.
I mean, I get emails every day from people about things and past shows, and they say, what happened to this person? I don't know. We can't find them. What happened to this person? I don't know. We can't find him.
Talk is cheap.
People want hard evidence nowadays.
Yeah. This is what we need to do. This is my whole purpose in this field, is to try to lay out as clearly as I can a factual basis for this. And
true.
You know, it's tricky because when you get into it long enough, you start encountering stories, and they're not all confirmable, and you have to really decide, what do I do with it? I'm continuing to try to be as careful as I can be and to document everything as carefully as I can and just do my best.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Richard Dolan on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Danny. I'm from Denver.
Hi.
On the fuzzy thing.
Hey, do me a favor. You sound like you're in the bottom of an ocean. Are you muffling yourself on purpose or what? I can't hear you.
Yeah, it's hard to hear you.
No, is this better?
Yes, much better.
Yeah.
Okay. On the subject of a lack of proof, how credible would you say Walter Haut is in his description of what happened to Roswell?
Well, you know, you may not know, there's been a controversy just lately in the last year regarding Walter Haut. Walter Haut was the public information officer.
And he just passed away, right?
Yes, he recently died.
Yeah.
His daughter runs the Roswell Museum in Roswell, New Mexico. And there is a controversy. I don't know all the details about this, in fact, because they're not all available, relating to what Walter Haut said privately on videotape, and what he has supposedly in a sealed letter. And this letter has not been revealed publicly. And he has some kind of major statement, and I just spoke with his daughter not just a couple of months ago, and she's not letting anyone see what's in this letter. This is like some major revelation that he has.
Now, a positive or negative? What do you think?
The impression I got is that it's a positive thing in the sense like that he's apparently confirming that he's been telling the truth about.
God, why won't she let that loose then?
I don't know. There are family issues. Apparently, there's personal stuff involved, and it's not anything that I have any control over. But I did meet with her. She's a really wonderful person, and I hope that she's able to release some more information on this. And, there's a video apparently that's in control of another UFO researcher has control of, and whether this is going to be released, I've got no idea. Is he credible? Yeah, he said, Haut's main thing, of course, is that he's the man who issued the press release on flying saucers. And to me, that's really the sum total of his importance. I mean, additional claims have to wait until I see evidence for this.
Right, and the military went back to him and had him yank it, right, and change the story.
Right, that's right. That's exactly it. And if in this letter or in this video he has other revelations that we can follow up on, great. Let's see what he has to say.
When does the extended portion of the book come out, taking us to 2006?
It's my next book, really. I expect to have it out. I kept saying end of 2006. I'm thinking early 2007. I'm working on it. It's coming along. I'm actually very happy with the writing. It's a longer book than I had originally planned. I was hoping to keep it to 500 pages, but it won't be less than 600.
And how about conferences for you, Richard?
I'll be speaking. It's possible that I'll be in the United Kingdom in a few weeks if they can nail this thing down for a conference in Bristol. But I'll definitely be at the Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas in early November. And after that, I don't really have too much lined up. I've actually been very low-key all year, George. I have not solicited or gone to too many conferences. My wife has attended more than I have.
Time to exploit yourself again, Richard.
Well, after the book's out, I imagine that I'll be out there.
Okay, my friend. Thanks for spending the 3 hours with us.
I had a great time talking with you and with the guests and just going into all the stuff that we've done. It's been great.
All right. Richard Dolan for Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and, of course, Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.